solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
I think I have come to learn a lesson in life that people will look at you the way you look at yourself. If as long as I was treating myself as a patient or as somebody who was disabled or have a sad persona around me or still despair losing legs and not moved on, I was looked upon like that. But the day I took charge of my situation, I said, no, I'm going to be as normal. Well, I'd never say that I'm abnormal. But I would. And actually, there is nothing that I don't do which people with all functions intact in their body do. I drive, I swim, I play, I watch movies, I listen to music, I cook, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a homemaker. And I write some poetry and I have hobbies. I travel. So there's really nothing really different. And that's what I crusade for. I call myself a person on a mission called Ability Beyond Disability, who actually advocates that the differences are, I think, just a matter of thought and not matter of action.
Welcome to the 32nd conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations across three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach, and I help leaders and organizations play to their potential by engaging with them during periods of high-stakes transition. The work I do falls in three broad buckets. First, enabling leaders transitioning to the next level in the context of a new role. Second, leadership transition in a company, where a new CEO is often brought in from a different company or a different geography, or an entrepreneur hires a senior leader during scale-up, and so on. I'm often the insurance policy in these situations, helping avoid hairline cracks become fractures. Third, individual career transition, where people are figuring out what next and are looking for a structured approach to discovering and landing into the next orbit. You could visit transitioninsight.com for more details. My guest this time is Deepa Malik, a lady who symbolizes the phrase ability beyond disability, in every sense of the word. She's a silver medalist at the Rio Paralympics, making her the first ever woman to win a medal in the Paralympics from India. She's won 58 national and 18 international medals in a sporting career that started at the age of 36, a time when most sportsmen would be retiring from the sport. She's paraplegic and has braved 183 stitches between her shoulder blades and three spinal tumor surgeries in the past 14 years. She was conferred the Arjuna Award in 2012 and Padma Shri in 2017. In this conversation, we talk about her journey, the choices she's made, and the mindset with which she's gone about accomplishing all that she has. At the outset, I should mention that if you want to listen to the conversation offline, say during an airplane ride or during a gym session, you could access it at iTunes, Google's podcast player, Stitcher, Savan, or any of the other podcast apps that are out there. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Deepa. Deepa, thank you so much for your time. Inspiring to meet you in person and talking to you.
I feel absolutely humbled. Thank you for this opportunity.
Maybe a good place to start, Deepa, is talk a little bit about how you spend your time today. I'm curious about how people organize their time. And how okay. That changes as they go through life. So talk to us a little bit about what you do and also why you do what you do.
I think the time management quality has been my biggest strength, and I'm very proud of it because it was inculcated as a very strong virtue. It was definitely a very strong part of our upbringing from our Fauji father. But I think if you keep the Fauji bit aside, or the army bit aside, even as a person, I saw my own father being very disciplined and very punctual and very a time management oriented kind of a person, and he taught us the art. And that way, me and my brother, we both are doing very well in our respective areas. I think that quality inculcated, I feel very, very grateful for that. And this was one virtue which helped me overcome my disability challenges. Because when you have chest below paralysis, and you have to time your food intake, your water intake, because your bladder and your bowel sensations are challenged and you don't feel them. And anything that I do from this body requires definitely a little more time than a regular person, or if I say an able-bodied person. Everything has to be timed. And what I do in a day, well, of course, each day is not really same.
Sure.
Nowadays it is, because I'm aggressively training for upcoming Para-Asian Games. We are just 2.5 months to go. So definitely the life is very disciplined as far as the training hours are concerned. But a lot of my time goes in, I'm a homemaker, so managing the home, the cleanliness in the house, what is to be cooked. And my diet has to be very closely maneuvered, especially during the training time. So I have to give those instructions. A lot of seminars, interviews like these. There are inspirational sessions that I take. Some time is dedicated in guiding and counseling people in various disabilities. I go through my emails and one by one I start answering them. So there's a lot that has to be done during the day.
Sure.
And honestly, one gedi is important. When I say gedi, means I have to step out. And even if it is just a very short drive, I drive my car or my motorcycle, even if I have to go and buy a packet of bread, I step out once a day.
Interesting. Interesting. And you spoke about your Fauji background.
Yes.
I'm also curious about how people's formative years shape them. In your case, if you were to say, what are the 2-3 things that have really shaped you and your attitudes to life?
That's very correct. I feel that when you are young and you are impressionable, whatever virtues are imbibed in you, they go a long way. And I always say that your team is never what you want them to be. It is who you are. And my father always led with examples. So did my mother. So we had role models within the house. Army upbringing and the qualities. First, of course, like I said, time management, the punctuality, because there is always an organized timetable and duty is assigned a day ahead. You know what is going to happen tomorrow. So the preparation for tomorrow, that has come in very handy, even if I align it to my sports training or I align it to my management of paralysis. So if I have worked and planned my day one day ahead, I am stress-free because I'm prepared for the next day. So this is one quality, and the major one is contingency planning. If plan A fails, how to quickly switch to plan B? So when you are not dependent on just one plan, you definitely don't give up on life. You immediately open the next door and you walk through that and you start working on your plan B. And there is always a very self-motivated, very self-confident, fearless attitude that army gives you, because you are always prepared for the unseen. Whether it's a war-like situation or you are dealing with ammunition, you are training for a war-like training. It's a very accident-prone job. And if you really look at it, your life is always at stake. So you're prepared for the accidents. And I think that is something which helped me prepare myself for this huge accident of losing my lower power in the limbs and moving on with the life.
And maybe just picking up from there, Deepa, you talk about Kargil, 1999, when your, I think, a tumor had relapsed.
Absolutely.
And you had to deal with this diagnosis amidst stories of casualties and fatalities from the war.
Yes.
Talk to us about how you navigated this passage of play.
You'll be surprised. I even got operated in the hospital, which was a major place where all the war casualties were flown in. That was Referral and Research R&R Hospital, New Delhi. I was referred from Jaipur to New Delhi. And while I was undergoing my checkups and the decisions of the surgeries, every hour a chopper would land. And the moment we would hear the chopper, the blades, the noise, everything would stand still for that moment. And my only question in my eyes that doctors could read was, may I know if my husband is alive? So, you know, it was a very difficult time when I look back. But again, there is a paradox out there. The thing which scared me the most gave me the most energy to face my own loss, because there were soldiers, average aged 25 years. Somebody had lost a leg. Somebody's eyes had blown off. Somebody had got paralyzed because of bullet injury in the head. Or somebody was perhaps going to die in some time. And I say that, and each one would smile, because what they had done was towards their nation. It was the line of duty. It was a level of patriotism. The higher the injury, the higher the love for the country. And they were not cribbing about it. Then what reason did I have? Because mine was a disease. It wasn't that I chose to go there and get paralyzed. So that gave me innate strength. At the same time, it gave me the biggest fear of losing my husband, because if I was going to either die on the operation table or remain chest below paralyzed, because at that point of time, I had no clue what is going to happen to my life. And the way everybody was reacting to that news given by the doctors, the general stereotypical impression given by society to me was that my life is going to end there. I'm going to be homebound. I'm going to be room bound. I will never be able to step out and do normal things in life. Or perhaps here on, I'm going to be a liability on the family. So it was scary. But yes, we did good. I won my battle over paralysis and my husband won the battle in Kargil, and we are moving on.
Well, and again, at that time, I read one of the articles which said that you had a choice between living on a wheelchair or continuing to walk till the end and face possible death. There was a choice to be made.
I chose life.
And how did you... Tell us, how did you think about the decision?
I think motherhood was my biggest strength. I wanted to be alive to see my children grow up, because my daughters were barely 7 and 3 and they were very young. And I think I was very possessive about my kids. I didn't want them to be brought up without my supervision. And I think that became a huge, huge strength. I'll be very honest. It was purely motherhood that made me choose to live. But eventually, disability gave a focus to my life, and it also gave a direction that I could, if I use my education in the right spirit and all the values which have been given to me by my parents and a supportive in-laws, so I could probably put all this together and make a difference. And I'm glad I was able to do that. To an extent, though there are miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep.
And again, one of the other pieces I'm curious about is how people recalibrate when they go through life-changing events. Let's say for a minute, if we look at a Deepa before all this happened, and a Deepa that came out of the operating theater with a successful operation and the husband's back from Kargil, how did you take stock of life and how did you recalibrate what you wanted to get out of life?
Actually, initially, it was just firstly, of course, learning the new body and the new life tricks, how to transfer, how to sit, what to eat, how to change a diaper, how to do catheterization. If you end up with constipation, how to do, how to take enema at home, the nursing, the physio, and the continued maintenance of the body within adopting it as a lifestyle, to be honest. And not just being treated like a patient throughout. So we all had to take charge. Children had to learn. Husband had to learn. We had to deal with our marital, the confusions, because this was a new body. And of course, we were a different couple earlier and we had to be a different couple later. The children had a different looking mother. So they had to relate to her. And my immediate family had to be very cautious in drafting lines and saying things because they were extra cautious that something they would said would should not have a double meaning or it should not come across as something said in a negative manner. So there was a lot of homework that we all had to do. When you say calibrate, of course, we chose to be happy. I think the key point and the code word was happiness. And that's why even the foundation that we have chosen to run, me and my elder daughter, we call it Wheeling Happiness. So we decided that this will be no melodrama. So the calibration rule was happiness and zero melodrama. So we stopped seeing those stereotypical Hindi movies where disability is always shown as sadness. And we started looking for the fun element to be brought into it. And I think the fun element could only come in because we had certain hobbies. I love to be a biker. I love to drive cars. I loved outdoor activities. I loved cooking. So all these passions and hobbies came together to calibrate and reset the life.
Very interesting. And now that you can probably look at that passage of play a little more dispassionately, for people going through, let's say, near-death experiences, if you will, yes. What are the 2-3 pieces of wisdom you want to share with for them to for them to have the courage to sail through those situations? What have you learned?
I think I have learned that life is the only festival that can be celebrated every day. We don't have to wait for dates, time, engagements, create time to do that. I think every day should be celebrated. The other experience that I felt or I personally decided, or you may call it a resolution that I made to myself. See, when I was walking to the operation theater, because I chose to do that, I did not want to be wheeled or put on a stretcher and taken. And when I took the last set of stairs I ever took in R&R Hospital, I was actually looking at my feet and realizing that I have legs. How many times do we stand up in front of the mirror and say, oh, I have hands. Oh, I have eyes. Oh my God, I do have feet on which I can walk. We never really take time to count our blessings. And one thing that I have learned is I look for happiness, one, positivity, two, and three, I take everything that come my way as a blessing. And I celebrate it. I have stopped postponement of things. I don't postpone anything anymore. If I want something or I want to do something or if there is something on my wish list, I try to act on it as soon as possible. Or maybe I can put it in a way that I don't wait for things to happen. I initiate the change. I take initiatives now. I don't wait.
Got it. And given your situation, Deepa, how do you strike the balance between seen as a regular person leading a regular life and an individual who's different from the rest? And the reason I ask is diversity and inclusion sometimes are two sides of the same coin. So how do you, how do you think about those two in terms of being just like anyone else versus being someone who's distinct from the rest? How do you process that?
I think I have come to learn a lesson in life that people will look at you the way you look at yourself. If as long as I was treating myself as a patient or as somebody who was disabled or have a sad persona around me or still despair losing legs and not moved on, I was looked upon like that. But the day I took charge of my situation, I said, no, I'm going to be as normal. Well, I'd never say that I'm abnormal. But I would. And actually, there is nothing that I don't do which people with all functions intact in their body do. I drive, I swim, I play, I watch movies, I listen to music, I cook, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a homemaker, and I write some poetry, and I have hobbies, I travel. So there's really nothing really different. And that's what I crusade for. I call myself a person on a mission called Ability Beyond Disability, who actually advocates that the differences are, I think, just a matter of thought and not matter of action. If you really take charge and do it as casually, people also take it that way. Initially, when I had recently got paralyzed and people saw the change from a walking Deepa to a disabled, severely disabled Deepa with so many medical challenges and body challenges. And at the same time, I think generally the Indian society is used to and understands that we are culturally not a very sensitized society. We do not have the kind of infrastructure and inclusion that is there outside India so we as a society in general do not accept disability so easily, or we are not knowledgeable enough to understand that yes, we have a way to cope up and live normally, inclusively with the challenges in the body also. Even if you see it mythologically or anything, they say it's bure karmo ka phal hai. There's always a negative connotation attached to it. It is never taken as part of life.
So you deserved it kind of an approach, right? Bure karmo ka phal is almost like saying...
Yeah, you deserve it. So there's a lot of guilt which has been imposed on you, that there is something wrong that you have done to deserve this. So to deal with a society which is used to these thoughts, it's definitely changing now with the current generation. But I am 2 decades old on the chair. So if I take you 20 years back, because with the internet coming in, with the phones, with WhatsApps, with these positive stories floating around, and a lot of media activity around changes and positive thinking, and like the recording that we are doing now, the thought process is changing, and corporates have come in with their MNC policies of inclusivity and diversity. So overall, the work culture and the thought culture is changing. But when I had got paralyzed, I faced all this, and I think the onus laid upon me to make the other person comfortable rather than the other person trying to make me comfortable. So once they saw that I was all right with the chair and I was happy within my space, then they would let their guards down and speak to me normally or include me. They would not talk about fashion, sari shopping, because I could no longer wear a sari. So they would delete the sari talks, not realizing that I would still like to talk about it. I would probably cherish some very good memories about wearing saris, or at least updating my information as to what is the latest fashion, being a fashionable woman myself. But slowly and steadily, a time came when I was the showstopper on the ramp shows. So this change of attitude, I think first, like I say, that people will look at you the way you look at yourself. So you have to create an aura around you. You have to help people around. So it comes to the communication skills. The way you learn soft skills in any business environment, I think this is also a learning like that. And a person who suffers with any kind of physical challenge can help the other person who does not understand. It's not their fault, because it is not as common.
Sure.
This is a unique situation which is not universally omnipresent. So obviously you don't expect everybody to understand it the way you do. You can only help them understand. So that's what I do. I make people understand my situation, and I also make them understand that I'm all right with it. And the moment they realize that if I'm okay with it, they're okay with it.
Very interesting. So you sort of take the onus of putting the other person at ease.
Yes.
Than giving the remote control to somebody else.
Absolutely.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. This segment of the conversation reminds me of my conversation with Meher Padamji, chairperson of Thermax, who spoke about how she and her mother dealt with the loss of her father and brother in quick succession.
You know, with my father, of course it was a shock, but in a way it was a sword hanging over his head because he smoked and he had had a bypass surgery, he had had a stent. And so it was like any time. With my brother, it was, why have you chosen my brother, you know, who's all of 25? And I was very, very angry with God, with the world. And I have to say, I don't know how my mother is such a huge pillar of strength. But she did a lot of reading on death. And she went through Vipassana after Dad died, after Kurush died. And she was really there in terms of saying that you can't ever say, why me? Just look around you. And truly, if we looked around us, you have to say, thank you, God. Mm. You know, the gratitude is far more than, why did you pick me?
This also reminds me of what Sheryl Sandberg says in the context of how she coped with her husband Dave Goldberg's sudden death. She talks about avoiding three P's when we're hit with shocks. First is personalization, which is asking the question, why me? Second is permanence, which is thinking that things are doomed forever. Third is pervasiveness, which is saying that everything around me is ruined. I guess it's easier said than done, but back to Deepa Malik's journey, the notion of taking it one day at a time and consistently choosing happiness over melodrama indeed does wonders. Now let's get back to our conversation with Deepa.
And the other theme I'm curious about, Deepa, is how you've thought about picking the next mountain to climb. Again, sort of metaphorically speaking, whether it's swimming or biking or shot put, how have you set those milestones for yourself?
You know, I was tired of those questions. Tabiyat kaisi hai? When are you going to be all right? So I really didn't know that what is everybody waiting for. This is a permanent situation. It's become part of my life. And what is the definition of achhi tabiyat? Physically, it's going to be a wheelchair. Emotionally, I am all right with it. My family has accepted it. We have found a way to work around the chair and the disability. But like I said, commonly people don't know or people are not used to it. So how do I declare this whole happy state of mind? And even if not happy, let me call it an accepted state of mind, where I have come into acceptance and I have adapted to the change and I have learned the skill to be part of this change and move on in life. So I started tapping on all my potentials and hobbies, and I started thinking of what can I do to declare to the world that my life is all right on a chair and I'm no longer a patient. Please start treating me like a person. And in that quest, my first and foremost was financial stability, because I was tired of being called a financial liability on the family. First step was to turn a restaurateur. A lot of learning went into that. I didn't know how to take a loan from the bank. I had absolutely no clue how to run a business. But I was open to asking for help. And that's what I tell everybody. The issue nowadays I see is there's a lot of egos. I know it all attitude. Or I just have to press a couple of buttons and Google Baba is going to tell me everything. I think first-hand experience and interaction, human-to-human interface, teaches you much more than this mechanical. Of course, it's good to get educated, but it's also very important to learn it practically. I had no hotel management background. I had no MBA skills.
And how did you pick running a restaurant, out of curiosity, off the various things you could do?
I think that was the first thing which came naturally to a housewife who knew cooking and who loved cooking. And I also found an opportunity there because the Ahmednagar area, the pocket in which we were living, had no home delivery counter. And we had a lot of army officers as students over there. And it is also an industrial kind of a town, and there's a lot of education there. So I felt that around the army area, we were missing home delivery counters. And young officers wanted food to be door delivered so that they could, they didn't have to get ready, go to the officers' mess, wait for their turn to come as junior officers. So, and then there were a couple of retired cooks who were also looking for an opportunity to set up something. So in one corner of the farmhouse, in that little farmland, we put a shed and a small kitchen, and we employed the underprivileged kids of the maids, the boys who were not able to pursue their education. So it became like a project which was interdependent, and the cooks got a job, I got something to do, the people around got a home delivery counter.
The whole ecosystem benefited.
Yeah, and these young boys were bartered by giving them a place of stay, clothes and books. And during the day, they had to pursue their education. In the evening, they had to deliver these packets. And from this small home delivery counter to a little restaurant to an absolutely flourishing catering business, 7 years, it was amazing. And a point came where I was earning more than my husband. I was not a liability, but I was giving a job opportunity to at least 20 staff members of my restaurant. So that was the first step.
Mm-hmm.
And once I found that stability financially, and I did not live on the guilt of eating into the family money to do what I wanted to do, I started traveling. I started looking for opportunities, done a biker, raised sponsorships, learned internet, started writing emails. And finally, I did get that. But my doctors told me that I need better rehabilitation. I needed to strengthen my upper body to be able to balance this whole body and have the strength to create a record. Because I thought, people will only listen to me and my voice will only be heard if I do something different. And a woman with chest pillow paralysis, when she'll ride a bike a certain distance, creating a record, probably her voice will be heard. And that'll leave an impact on the society. It was personal as well as there was a goal which was value addition. And to do that, I started doing hydrotherapy, which meant I had to exercise in water. And I realized that this body was not drowning, rather swimming. And that is where a para swimmer came out, and swimming also became a journey.
Okay, and when did this quest for the Olympics start?
Oh, I think that was the habit of doing a job properly with full dedication and reaching the 100% mark. Because that is what we have been taught, that a real person, a real hero is when you can do the task that you have undertaken to best of your capacity and to the highest level of performance. So I guess when I turned a biker, I created a world record. When I became a rallyist and a car driver, I created a world record. When I became a swimmer, I created a world record. So if I had become a sportswoman and an athlete, a thrower, I could not let my journey end without reaching the topmost sports arena and winning there. It's just a pursuit of excellence and excelling over excellence. I think that is what was the main reason, maybe.
How do you pick? I'm also curious about the sport people pick to excel. So of the various things, whether it's swimming or let's say short put, how did you zero in on shot put as the sport that you will compete in at the Olympics?
You'll be surprised, beggars can't be choosers. If I had to be at London Paralympics in 2012, for which I was training, I had to be a javelin thrower because that was the only event in my disability category in that particular year. Unfortunately, I could not make it to London Paralympics. But since I was practicing it, I created an Asian record, which I still hold in javelin throw. I became Asia ranking one and I picked up an Asian medal in 2014 in javelin, becoming world number two in my category. And I was very, very sure that's going to be javelin hereafter. But to my horror and my surprise, in 2015, when the event list for Rio Paralympics came out, the only event I had in my category was shot put. And again, you'll be surprised to know that the only event in my category in 2020 in Japan, Tokyo, is going to be discus. So we don't choose. The only thing we choose is, do we want to be at that level playing in this particular competition? If you want to do that, you have to learn the skill. And that has been the key. I have always been willing to learn. I always say that even today when I go to the grounds, I go there to learn, to train. In spite of having 68 national golds and 21 international medals, including the ones from Asian Games, Paralympics, World Championships, Commonwealth, I still say that I'm going to learn.
And if I may ask, just out of curiosity, which of these medals are you the most proud of? Is there one medal that stands out in your mind as something that you're most proud of in terms of accomplishment?
See, definitely people would think that it is the Rio Paralympics medal, which of course I'm very, very proud of because that has created history for the entire nation. We were starving for a medal from a female in para-athletics or para-sports, because my medal won at Paralympics is the first ever across any sport. It is special. But the best one was 2010 Asian Games medal for me, which was a bronze.
Mm-hmm.
That was again the first ever won by a female athlete, the first Asian Games medal. Why it is special? Because that medal turned me into a sports activist. That medal gave me the capacity to stand up and demand at par treatment. Because for similar medals from Asian Games, the able-bodied were getting a lot of recognition, awards, cash awards. And with this medal in my hand, I had got the ticket to raise a voice for the para sports equal treatment. And when I did that, I did started making a proper report and filing it to bureaucrats, to politicians, demanding at par treatment and cash awards, and also requesting for future training programs, because able-bodied were being inducted into training programs post their performances in Asian Games towards the London OPEX scheme. So this is a very special medal, and thanks to this medal and all the activity around it, I became a member in the five-year planning commission as a working group member from the HRD division of sports ministry, rooting for some policies for disability sports. So it was a huge turning point.
And you spoke about excellence a couple of minutes back. What's been your approach to excellence? I'm curious. I was talking to Viren Raskina, who runs mm-hmm. Olympic Gold Quest.
Yes.
And one of the questions I asked him was, what differentiates the athletes who get onto the podium versus the athletes who are really good but somehow fall short at the bigger stage? What's been your learning in terms of, really excelling at the highest level?
I think a dedicated focus, perseverance, continuous training, consistency is the key, I guess,
mm-hmm.
With focus. I used to think that they're very cliched, very stereotyped dictionary terms, which have been often used to form quotations. But you pick up any success story, you will see there is a very strong element of self-belief, self-discipline, focus, dedicated, consistent hard work. Because there is definitely no shortcut to success. If you want to be the winner, you have to go through these words. when they are totally imbibed in your system.
And is there anything to be said about giving your best on that day? What's your ritual before you, let's say, if we look at the Rio Silver?
Yes.
Talk to us about what was how your mind worked before you threw the silver medal winning throw.
You'll be very surprised. The person who was throwing the throw there was not an athlete. It was a person who was struggling to clear her name because she was accused of being dishonest, cheating into the selection trials. I was dragged to the High Court by a fellow competitor because there was one slot for a woman to represent India. And I made it to that slot in the internal trial process. But they said that I had cheated my way into it, or I had bribed my way into it. And coming from an entirely army background, which is, you know, the uniform wearing people, and being brought up in that very honest kind of a dedicated kind of an atmosphere, it was a huge blow to my integrity and the hard work that I had put in at the age of 46 years, going through menopause, a time where I had to be actually sitting by my children and crafting their career. I was so dedicatedly, single-mindedly struggling for representing India at the Paralympics, and the preparations were so strong that I knew I was going to get a medal home. But these allegations became a different kind of a fire in me. And when I was challenged that I'll never be able to throw the distance with which I got qualified into the main selection, so my whole focus was that if I have to repeat that performance, and had I repeated that performance, in any case, I was in the medal position. So it had become a two-way journey as an athlete and as an individual who wanted to prove a point of integrity. The other thing was, definitely, I say that your preparations tell you where you stand, and they leave you with a level of confidence. So if you have trained well and you have been able to retain a calmness in your mind, I had to learn to erase the outside noises. I would probably get distracted because there's a bugle blowing, people clapping, there is a gunshot, because simultaneously a lot of events go on in the same arena. You have the start burst for races, you have people cheering. So this is something that I had to learn to block. And I give a lot of credit to my mental trainers who worked on me.
Mm-hmm. And talking about coaches, if I may use the term broadly,
yes.
The other piece I'm curious about is, you know, what differentiates the great coaches from the good ones? What about them enables them to get the most out of an individual, whether it's an athlete or whether it's a CEO or whether it's, a voice artist? So what's been your experience of working with great coaches?
So personally, in my case, you'll be surprised that I hardly had a coach, a proper coach, or I failed to probably get a person who could understand my body. It's so severely disabled that the stereotypical style of teaching a person normally does not work with me, because I have spasticity and the body does not react continuously in the same way. The messages from the brain does not get passed. The neurons are damaged. So this time I chose to work with a biomechanics gym trainer and worked more on the diet, the psychology, and the muscle strengthening and a repetitive practice of the brain to be able to carry the message to my particular part of the muscle that needs to be used. So I think that worked in my favor, and a lot of mental training I worked on, because psychologically I was under a lot of pressure that the equipment is heavier, the age is against me, and I'll never be able to do it because there is a certain age of doing it. So I had to work on myself, but still, not taking away the fact that everybody needs a coach. And what differentiates a coach, I would feel, and if we talk in terms of a team leader or a CEO, I think the people who can keep the team motivated. There has to be a Jeff and Mutt theory there.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be always putting the other person down. Or I think that is something which should be a standard rule for parenting also. That's how we always read about good parenting, that rather than picking up the negatives or conveying it in a negative connotation, instead of saying that you did not throw well, you say in next one you will throw better. I think that approach makes a person more motivated. A good coach or a good CEO is someone who can motivate his team or the student in a way that the person is happy coming back to the training ground the next day. It should be a happy space where the person feels very, very motivated to work. And that's the reason I had to change coaches and finally not have one during my journey for the Rio Paralympics, because I was not getting that self-motivation going to them. So I erased all that and I chose a person who could actually make me believe that I can do it.
Got it. You spoke about mental training. What have you discovered about sort of the power of the mind in these situations? Again, if you could sort of demystify mental training for us. So what do these mental trainers do?
I think in my case, I was not believing in myself, which is again, there's a lot of metaphysical conceit there. A person who's a motivational speaker was not. So somewhere in my mental training, I was told that you can do it. You have the capacity to do it. And I realized that it's always mind over body. It's, you become what you think you would become. So that self-belief was the part, because somewhere I was not able to believe that I had the potential to throw the shot put, which is a heavy equipment, to a distance where I can place myself on the podium in Rio Paralympics. So I think that is where, and which is, I think, is a major, major thing, because my strength was telling me I can. My muscle training and the kind of weight I was lifting in the gym, or the endurance I had in throwing during a throw practice, that was clearly saying that I'm going to do it. But my mind was not telling me that I'll be able to do it. So it was very important for me to know that I will be able to do it.
And how do mental trainers instill that belief? What do they do to give you that belief?
I think it's just, on a lighter side, my mental trainer, she told me, she says, Deepa, there's a typical woman and a housewife, middle class housewife mentality working in you. Just because you have paid me, you want to utilize that knowledge. So it's a passive vasool theory. Just because you had paid me a lot, you are following it, you know, like how you buy a piece of clothing or a shoe and then you ragdo it till the end.
Yep.
Ki, you know, jab tak bilkul nahi fat jayega, main isko use karungi. So it is a simple theory that I knew it all. I'm a 46-year-old educated woman from an educated background. I absolutely knew whatever she has to tell me, but just because I paid her to do that, I stuck by it to utilize it. So what is there? That the knowledge is there. But we're not willing to utilize it. And that was the only difference, I think.
Got it. And I think bringing it back to the corporate setting, there's enough research that says that for us to navigate through to the future, one of the, let's say, the meta skills required is resilience.
Yes.
And in a way, you've sort of been through enough and more mountains physically and metaphorically. What have you learned about, again, if you had to, again, decode resilience for us and say, you know, when you're faced with a situation, these are the 3-4 traits or 3-4 muscles you need to build for you to be resilient during tough times?
I think the biggest help that can come from in maintaining resilience or facing a particular situation is to automatically shift into the solution finding game rather than harping on the problem. So that's what I do. Whenever I'm faced with a challenge, I immediately start looking for a solution, how to go about it. And solution finding will again come back to learning. Learning about the situation. Or I think in other words, a challenge is a change. Because you want a thing to happen in a certain way and it doesn't. So, which automatically says that there is a change. How good are you in adapting to a change? How flexible you are to quickly mold yourself into the situation? I think that automatically sets the bar of your resilience. If you're rigid, you're not adapting to a change, you're not willing to learn about the change, you don't want to find a solution to tackle with the situation, then where will the resilience come from? It's that. So I think I am very quick to find solutions or alternatives. So it, I think, goes back to the fact that do you have a contingency planning, which I think also reflects the same thing as finding a solution.
Got it. And you've had a team of people helping you out with your various pursuits, whether it's biking or swimming or shot put.
Yes.
What have you learned about building and managing a team to achieve your objectives?
I think a good team is the one which has a common goal. It should not be that they are in it because it is Deepa's dream. They have to dream the same dream to be the right kind. And if you have a team which is dreaming it with you, then you're in the right set of people. It just doesn't have to be your journey. They have to be an equal part of that journey. Take equal responsibility of that journey. And then probably you have the right team on your side. And I was being very fortunate when I wanted to be a biker, the people who were supporting me or who were working with me or who were guiding me really wanted me to be on that bike. They really wanted me to do that. So similarly, when I started my journey and my struggle to be a rallyist, those who joined hands ensured that I took the flag off. So then it becomes the right team. So firstly, you have to identify like-minded people. Second, try and look for positive attitude people. Because people who are positive in their outlook will be a happy persona, will be a persona who has the art of gratitude. And the moment you have an art of gratitude, you are somebody who knows how to count your blessings. So I think if you can identify these little qualities in somebody, you, or inculcate these qualities in somebody by good communication, a clear communication, and, you know, making them see things the way you see things, then you are in the right kind of a team.
And how do you think about your goals and aspirations about the future? How do you take stock of, how have you taken stock of life at different points in time? And how do you think about the future from here on?
I have always had a plan. I have always set myself another benchmark. So while I'm working hard for this, I don't leave myself an empty space. I immediately have my next target online. So that also keeps me going, I guess. And it helps me raise my bar each time. For now, it is Asian Games. And post that, I'm very clear that I have to start working in my foundation, Wheeling Happiness. Because it's time to spread the light. Pass on the baton and have more Deepas coming up. And that's what we need. There is immense talent out there that needs to be nurtured, that needs to be brought out into the light and some guidance. And if I can become the medium of a change in somebody's life, like how people have become mediums. So it's time to give back now. So that's the next goal I have. Right now, Like I have Asian Games to look forward to.
And this is discus, is it? Or which sport is this?
Discus also I have qualified. Okay. Javelin is also there. So this time I'm going to be doing two events in a major competition.
And you spoke about wheeling happiness. So for the purpose of the listeners, give us an insight into what that's about and what you're trying to do with the foundation.
It was my daughter's brainchild. It was her initiative. And my elder daughter met with an accident. She was just barely a year and a half. And due to the head injury, she got hemiplegia, which is the left of her body got entirely paralyzed. And after that, I got my tumors back. So I got paralyzed. So actually, we are two of us who have motivated each other and done a physiotherapy together and overcome our challenges. And both of us are probably the only mother-daughter duo in the world who played together in parasports.
Does she compete for India as well?
Yes, she has represented India and she has somehow chosen this field and probably felt the need or understood the advantages of emotional happiness in the process of overcoming disability, because she has seen it in me. She has had first-hand experience in her own life. And right now she's pursuing probably the only one in India to go to the world number one sports college university, which is Loughborough University, UK. And she's pursuing a PhD course in disability sports psychology. So she's kind of dedicated her life to betterment of this particular sector and to bring hope to life of people and become a medium to create an inclusive and accessible India. And not just physically, but emotionally and mentally also sensitize people. So we do a lot of counseling sessions. We encourage people. We support them to pursue their hobbies, because we feel that if a person is first happy, then that person will be able to deliver, learn, adapt in a better way. If you are already in a sad space, how do you expect that person to be motivated enough to come out of that and become somebody who can achieve, or somebody who can work, or somebody who can be out there in the world doing things for him or herself? So that's how we call it wheeling happiness. We try and help people find their sources of happiness.
And how do you do that, if I may ask?
We do a lot of seminars. We do a lot of interactive sessions, a lot of updation through our pages. And then a lot of people connect to us. For example, someone wants to learn driving because they have seen me driving. It's like leading with an example and asking people to follow pursuit. And then it's a very small initiative, but I'm very proud and happy that Devika has won the Queen's Young Leader Award for it at Buckingham Palace. And she's currently working very closely with the Commonwealth Youth Council while she's there in England.
Wonderful.
She recently became a voice of the youth at the Commonwealth Government Heads meeting, which was opened in Buckingham Palace this March. And she made that appeal to the 53 government heads for having this whole planet a little more inclusive and give equal opportunities. So we are also fighting for the rights. We are helping people with sports wheelchairs or some kind of supplements or sports equipment, or if somebody wants to work out of home, so helping them learn the computer skills and then getting them a laptop. So whatever way they can be emotionally happy, we are trying to work at that.
Very, very inspiring, and best wishes.
Yes, with thank you so much.
With the foundation. And just a couple of questions as we wrap up, Deepa. One is, again, when you really look back at your journey, and without being modest, what about you has enabled you to come this far and achieve so much?
I always say that there's only one disease I suffer from, and which is happiness. To be able to remain happy in whatever circumstances I was has left me sane enough to plan, to look around for positivity, to look for opportunity. Because I think a sad person is a closed mind. So the happy hormones have worked for me.
And what's the secret behind staying happy through
situations? Look at the positive sides of things. Make the best of what I have had and worked hard to best of my capacity.
And this podcast is titled Play to Potential, mm-hmm. which is for each person to discover his or her the path where they show potential and really play their best game that they can. So what would your advice be for the listeners to this podcast for them to play to their potential?
See, it's very, very important to be honest to yourself. I love playing guitar, but you never really pick it up and play. I want to write a book, but you've never made notes. How will you ever do it? So I think the best way to find your potential and reach your optimum is to be honest to yourself. If you've set a goal for yourself, then honestly work towards it. No shortcuts, no postponements, no cheating to yourself. Because excellence will only come when you have very honestly put your best foot forward.
Deepa, it's been a real honor spending this last hour and a bit with you. Wish you and your daughter and your family the very best in your pursuits. And thank you so much.
Thank you. And it's been really nice going through the whole journey again. I think this conversation has left me again very inspired because you must practice what you preach. And I'm again going to revise the whole thing and work even harder for my Asian Games.
Lovely, and wish you the very best for that.
Thank you so much.
I hope you found the conversation purposeful. There were three big takeaways for me in this. First, happiness is a choice and has nothing to do with your situation. It was really interesting to hear Deepa say that the way people treated her was a function of how she treated herself. Given what she's been through, if she can choose happiness over melodrama, I'm sure all of us can. Second, is the notion of actions rewiring our identity. Sometimes we think that when we're hit with a shock, we can think our way into a new identity, but I do believe the way we act into a new self can make a profound difference in the way we shape our new identity. It's fascinating to see Deepa move on to set up a catering business, then move on to doing car rallies, then swimming, and eventually compete in the Olympics. It's never a slingshot, but a series of small, consistent steps that often leads to extraordinary outcomes. Third, she uses the term dedicated and consistent hard work. This reminded me of a distinction I came across recently. It was at the Farnham Street blog run by Shane Parrish. He talks about the difference between speed and velocity. He says speed is distance divided by time, and velocity is displacement divided by time. And the key difference is that you could cover a lot of distance by spinning around in circles, but not going anywhere. Displacement is about consistently making efforts in a certain direction and making them count. And when you add these baby steps over a period of time, suddenly these people start operating at a very different level. Thank you for listening. If you find the content purposeful, please share with those that could find this valuable, and do take a moment to rate and review on iTunes. To access more content, please visit playtopotential.com. To know more about the consulting work I do, please visit transitioninsight.com. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.